work camps and the pain of losing your family. I admit I no longer remember all the answers I have given, but I am sure that they often varied and depended on my mood. The part of my formative years over which fate casts such a large shadow imposes an enormous burden and is not fully sorted out even now. No manual for survival was ever handed to me, nor were any self-help books available. Yet somehow I made my way, grappling with feelings that would let me reconcile difficult memories with hope for the future, and balancing pain with joy, death with life, loss with gain, tragedy with happiness. Survival is both an exalted privilege and a painful burden. I shall take a few random incidents that have become important in my life and try to make some sense of them. At the same time, I realize that it is impossible to do justice to 50 years of memory. The acuteness of those recollections often penetrates the calm of my daily life, forcing me to confront painful truths, but clarifying much through the very act of evocation. I have learned, for the most part, to deal with those truths, knowing well that a painful memory brought into focus by a current incident still hurts, but also that the pain will recede, as it has, and ultimately fade away. When, in September 1946, the wheels of the plane bringing Kurt, my husband, and me from Paris and London touched American soil, he tightened his arms around me and said simply, "You have come home." It has been home, better than I ever dreamed it would be. I love this country as only one who has been homeless for so long can understand. I love it with a possessive fierceness that excuses its inadequacies, because I deeply want to belong. And I am still fearful of rejection, feeling I have no right to criticize, only an obligation to help correct. I marvel at my 3 children's total acceptance of their birthright and rejoice in their good fortune. The establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 helped me to become a better American. The pain and loss I experienced in Poland, the country of my birth, obliterated the nostalgic thoughts of a childhood home for which I yearn. I have found the answer to that longing in the tradition of my religion and in the land of my ancient ancestors. Israel, by extending the law of return to all Jews, has become the metaphorical sepulcher of my parents as well as my spiritual childhood home. While my love for Israel represents my love for my parents and our shared past, the United States is my country of choice, my adult home. This country represents the love I harbor for my husband, my children, and my grandchildren. One complements the other. By being mutually supportive, they enrich and heal. I fell in love with this country from the moment I first stepped upon its soil. It felt so right, so expansive, so free, so hospitable, and I desperately wanted to become part of the American mainstream. I had envisioned Buffalo, which was to become my American home, as a utopian city beneath an ever-blue, brilliant sky, and had dismissed Paris, London, and New York, my way stations to this utopia. During the drive from the grand, imposing New York Central Railroad Station in Buffalo, I was confronted with my new city's small wooden houses, huddled together like refugees, but my disappointment lasted only a few moments. I was ready to love the city and willing to defend it, even to myself. My affection was not misplaced. Buffalo did become a true home. It nurtured me, and later my children played and laughed under rows of elm trees while I immersed myself in a new life. In time, we would move from our first apartment to another part of the city, but I would occasionally drive past the familiar location that held so much of our early memories. I would remember how it had seemed to me on my first night in Buffalo, and a picture would flash through my mind. Long after Kurt had fallen asleep, I roamed through the apartment's modest rooms, stopping at the refrigerator in the tiny kitchenette that Kurt's friends had amply stocked. I had always loved fruit, so I took out an apple. But before I could catch the door, it slammed shut with a bang, and terror seized me. How many years had it been since I had lived in a home where I could take whatever I wanted with impunity? It was all mine now, the apple and the refrigerator. I opened the door, fully intending to let it slam shut. Instead, I caught it in time, closed it gently, and grateful, went to bed. Looking up at that third-story window of our first home, I also recalled the day which catapulted me into my life's work. I came to Buffalo in September 1946, and the following incident must have happened in late November. I loved going to grocery stores and still do. In those days, I had the handy explanation that it was a great way to learn English, since I would see pictures on labels of cans that would tell me what was inside, an easy way to learn new words. The truth was different. I needed to convince myself of the abundance of available food and of its never-ending supply. I wanted the assurance of never being hungry again. On that particular fall day, I must have dawdled in the market longer than I thought, because when I left the store, a snowstorm was gathering. I made it home, wind-blown, wet and cold, and unpacked my bag on the kitchen table. Among my purchases was a loaf of bread, a whole loaf of bread, all mine. I took it into the living room and sat near the window watching the icy gales swirling outside as I began to eat. Somehow it tasted soggy and a bit salty. What was wrong with me? Here I was, sitting in a warm, secure place with a whole loaf of bread. Why, then, did I feel so sad, so forlorn? Slowly the answer began to dawn. During the long years of deprivation, I had dreamed of eating my fill in a warm place, in peace, but I never thought that I would eat my bread alone. Later that evening, I told Kurt that I had been thinking of my friend still in Europe, cold and hungry. I had to do something. Out of that need evolved my work with the local Jewish Federation, where I soon found myself putting stamps on envelopes and sealing them. I was immensely proud of having become a volunteer. When Kurt's aunt cautioned me that volunteer work was really for the wealthy, I agreed wholeheartedly. I considered myself rich now. It didn't take long before the director of the office suggested that there were other ways to help. Could I tell some of the Buffalo Jewish community what I had seen and lived through? He waved aside protestations about my halting, faulty English. It did not matter that I was not articulate. He assured me that I would somehow manage to convey my feelings. And so, in the fall of 1946, I tried to tell my story, and I have continued to do so ever since. Thus I became involved in the concerns of United Jewish Appeal and Hadassah, and with the creation of the State of Israel my work intensified. It became clear to me that the idea of helping others need not be confined to victims of the Holocaust. The welfare of all children has always been of utmost importance to me, the abused, the handicapped, the underprivileged, the ill. I can identify with them because I know what it is like not to be able to communicate one's pain and hope. I had learned, above all, that even after cataclysmic events, I was able to laugh again. Of course, I had the resilience of youth on my side. My experience has taught me that all of us have a reservoir of untapped strength that comes to the fore at moments of crisis. Throughout my years in the camps, and against nearly insuperable odds, I knew of no one who committed suicide. I wanted to reach out to young people, make them aware of the preciousness of life, and show them that it was not to be thrown away thoughtlessly, even under conditions of extreme hardship. I always wanted to impress upon them how wrong it is to seek a permanent solution to a temporary problem. I feel gratified that in their letters to me, those youngsters treat me more as a peer than as someone of their grandparents' generation. In that way, I feel rewarded beyond all expectations. In Buffalo, our circle of friends widened, and I began to find my niche in American life. I learned, however, the great difference between my experiences and those of our new friends. Normal life for me had stopped with the outbreak of the war when I was 15. I had a big social gap during my adolescence, when my American contemporaries had grown up in normal fashion. I had resumed my life at 22, married and settled in a strange country, having only an inkling of its language and customs. My normal development was retarded, and yet I had a lifetime of terrifying experience behind me. Wasn't it traumatic to make the transition to normality? How often I have been asked that question, and I have come to the conclusion that, yes, perhaps it was. But I didn't know what the word trauma implied, and I would have been ashamed to admit any dissatisfaction, believing it to be selfish and ungrateful to complain about anything here. In retrospect, I think that coming to America was like stepping out of a dark, oppressive room in which I had been locked up for a long, long time. Once I was free and exposed to light again, the most ordinary objects, the simplest things, acquired an aura of extraordinary beauty, desirability, and value. I reveled in the joy of discovery, and my gratitude was boundless. I have almost total recall of certain moments from my early years, at home and in the camps, but that, too, can be a sword, albeit double-edged, with which to slay contemporary dragons. Such a duel is all the fiercer if the adversaries share the same body. For many years, for example, I could not articulate the word furnace. I would substitute the euphemism heating unit when speaking to a repairman who came to the house to fix it. I found that it was less of a jolt to think about the word than to articulate it. I learned, though, that fear would recede more quickly if I immersed myself in routine chores. Cooking soup and folding cool linen can be great healers. Plunging into community work has yielded the greatest satisfaction while warding off dark memories. There are, however, pains that will not go away, adding their burden over extended periods of time. They are more infrequent, but when they recur, they often cut far deeper. Though I know their roots, I am still unable to deal with them. I am resigned to accepting the small, indelible scars they leave each time. Recently, in preparation for our son's visit to Arizona, where we now live, and knowing how much he likes fruit, I stocked up on it. On the last morning of his visit, when it turned out that the abundant supply had dwindled to nothing, he couldn't refrain from teasing me gently about my lack of foresight. After he left for the airport, I found the bag of fruit I had stashed in a far corner of the refrigerator. I stood there engulfed by a choking feeling of guilt and bereft of the radiant warmth I had enjoyed during his visit. Instead, I experienced a stabbing memory of a hot day more than half a century ago. I was with my parents living in the basement of our home in Bielitz. The war had already gone on for 2 years, and we had just received word that my Aunt Peppy and her children were in Auschwitz. How this news reached us, I no longer remember. My cousin Rose, at 17, was my contemporary, and her younger brother, Josef, must have been about 10 years old. My mother decided to send a package to them and set out to make one of her special recipes, rum balls. Although they were ersatz, she brought all her skills to the task, improvising and using up carefully hoarded oats and other ingredients to make them as tasty as possible. Mama allowed me to try some of the confection, which was delicious to my ravenous teenage appetite. The rest, well over 40 of them, were set out to dry. When Mama left the room, I swiped one more, gulping it down quickly before the package was sent off, along with a few other goodies. As it turned out, the parcel came back a week or two later, bearing the legend, "Undeliverable." So much for German efficiency. Intercepting the look of consternation and dismay, I saw my parents' eyes meet. To me, they made light of the matter, commenting on how fortunate Aunt Peppy and the children were to be able to leave that camp, quite likely to a safer place in the interior of Poland, where my aunt must have joined my uncle. Somehow none of it rang true. I remember leaving the basement and standing upstairs in the stifling heat of the afternoon. I felt a vague sense of oppression, a pervasive loneliness that had nothing to do with Aunt Peppy. I was racked with guilt, although I realized even that my having taken that extra rum ball couldn't possibly have mattered to my aunt and cousins, even if the package had reached them. All I knew was that it mattered to me then, and still does now. There is nothing I can do about it but bear the pain. It occurs every time I forget to give something to someone I love, even though I know that, fortunately, they can obtain it easily. Those moments of pain are richly compensated for by others of immense joy. The most welcome were those when I held my newborn children, and later my grandchildren in my arms. Alyssa, Andrew, and Lindsay, our daughter Vivian's children, Julie, Melissa, and Jessica, those of our daughter Leslie, and Jennifer and Alexa, our son Jim's daughters. I am awed by the marvel of creation, the mysterious spark in these new lives, which continue the chain of generations stretching back to time immemorial, imbuing it with the divine. To close the gap of what was left uncompleted, to create an existence that was meant to be denied, represents a triumph over evil. I realize with wonder and gratitude that in my body reposed some part of shared ancestry with those deprived of life, and that I was given the privilege of being a link between generations. At the risk of being overly sentimental, I must say something about my American family, the center of my universe. I cannot think of my husband, Kurt, as a separate human being. From the moment we met, he became an integral part of me. My thoughts and emotions center on him. There has never been a you and me, but always we and us. Our lives are closely interwoven. Of course we have disagreed on occasion, and he has often chided me about my unrealistic expectations. Yet he has always supported me in all my endeavors. His caring gallantry and sound judgment help me to maintain my equilibrium. He has totally redeemed my trust in him and the love I hold for him. Our children have been a source of pride and a wellspring of our happiness. It would take reams of paper to describe who they are and what they mean to us, but the memory of just a few of their expressions during their formative years will do. As young children and later as adolescents, they listened to my stories and anecdotes about growing up, about my parents, brother, and grandparents. My mother used to make the first ice cream of the season in honor of my birthday in May. I adored her ice cream, but if the day was a cool one, she would make me wear a scarf before I could swallow my favorite dessert. For my typically American children, this story became a source of endless hilarity. Once, when my birthday fell on an especially cool day in Buffalo, our older daughter Vivian wanted to know, "Would Grandma have made you wear a scarf today?" Our middle child, Leslie, moved me to tears years later by owning up to a recurring daydream during her childhood, a fantasy of finding her grandparents somewhere on the way to school and bringing them home to us. And our son, Jimmy, revealed his feelings in the course of a discussion that centered on his friend's grandparents. I asked whether he ever talked to his friends about his grandparents. He responded with a laconic no, and when I pressed him for an explanation, he said simply, "Oh, Mom, I didn't want to brag." I'm gratified that our parents did not become ghosts that haunted our children's nightmares. Rather, the children still think of them as loving and very human grandparents. Obviously, there was this void in their lives that they sought to fill for their own sake and for ours. At the same time, our parents still serve as role models in whose martyrdom and bravery they could take great pride. Our children have grown into caring adults. They have made good, solid marriages and have presented us with 8 cherished grandchildren, thus extending our family to yet another generation. Once, after years in the United States, I was part of a United Jewish Appeal mission to Amsterdam, where I met a friend of Anne Frank's, a BBC journalist whose broadcasts were relayed by stations in Belgium and Germany. She asked me to do a program with her based on my wartime experiences. The interview, I assumed, would be conducted in English. When she asked me to do it in German, I became petrified. To speak German on the radio was something completely out of my province. Hitler, Goebbels, and their cohorts had spoken on the radio, and to me, this made it forever theirs. My new friend was quite persuasive, and after much further hesitation, I agreed. But the interview turned into a devastating experience. A paralyzing fear gripped me, and the walls of safety that English had built around me came tumbling down. After a short while, I could not go on. It made me realize how fortunate I had been that Kurt had insisted from the very beginning that for the most part we speak English. That is to say, I could turn to German whenever English failed me, but he would answer me in English until I slowly, spontaneously spoke only in English. My sole regret then, and it persists to this day, was that despite my frantic desire to learn English, I could not shake my accent. Alas, that was never to be, although I would score an occasional unexpected triumph, such as my encounter with a very southern lady in Louisiana. After speaking with me for a while, she said, "I always like to hear a Yankee talk." My elation remains unforgettable. I also found that language can become a buffer, a filter for emotions, a free zone to which I can safely retreat. Most of my friends were not so fortunate. Many married other survivors who spoke little English, and for years they could not break out of the world of their native tongue. That makes it more difficult to speak of the past, because the memories are apt to turn into the living present. Some time ago, while I was driving, a lilting melody from the radio filled the car. I knew the song and lustily chimed in. Im Waisenrüssel am Wolfgangsee, da steht das Glück vor der Tür. I could hear my mother's voice asserting that at the White Horse Inn on Lake Wolfgang in Austria, happiness was waiting at the door. I could hear her and see her eyes lighting up with joy, her lips curved in a smile, until suddenly reality set in. Even though I knew that the White Horse Inn had nothing to do with the events of the '40s, and that the music was written by a Jew, the song instantly lost its carefree lilt. Angrily snapping the radio off, I drove on in gloomy silence. All I could think was, they have robbed me not only of my youth, of my parents, but also of the comfort of words, of the images of tender sustaining memory. Despite Bielitz's status as a Polish town, it still retained some of its former Austrian character during my childhood. Thus, my mother tongue was German. That language certainly had its lyrical beauty, but for me the Nazis succeeded in perverting it into the strident, staccato cadences that implied and expressed ominous threats. It was in these tones that my parents' terrible death warrant had been decreed. I railed against the injustice of it all, of being orphaned in so many subtle ways. One good thing came out of it, though. The knowledge that my native tongue became repugnant to me strengthened my resolve to steep myself even more in my new language. It was fascinating to choose words from this seemingly inexhaustible font. I would acquire them in order to express what I needed to say. Safely ensconced in the new home I had quickly come to know and love, I was caught up in the rhythm of everyday life. Season followed season as our three children grew up. We rejoiced in watching them develop and applauded their achievements. While we were still living in Buffalo, I visited Vivian in Arizona, where she had moved with her husband soon after getting married. From there I was to fly to Washington, D.C. to address an important meeting. In a hurry to get to the airport, I hadn't changed and was wearing old slacks and a blouse spotted with baby formula, which had spilled on me while I fed my baby granddaughter on the way to the plane. Upon my arrival in the nation's capital, I tried to retrieve my luggage, only to discover that it had gone astray, leaving me stranded in my hardly appropriate attire at an expensive penthouse among elegantly dressed, bejeweled guests. My embarrassment was soon dispelled by a vivid memory of trudging through the snow and the biting cold on the death march during the final months of the war. The scene recaptured was of a ramshackle house in the twilight. Through a window, I could see a few people sitting down to supper. I recalled clearly what it had meant to me at that moment, the surge of envy of the unattainable luxury enjoyed by those inside. I remembered the penetrating cold, the hunger and loneliness of that evening. I would gladly have signed away everything that lay in my future had I been allowed to enter that hovel, find shelter by the fire, and sit down to warm food. It came to me, how dare I be embarrassed today by traces of formula from my granddaughter's bottle? This was a crisis which the sharp edge of memory was able to control swiftly. Another memory had just the opposite effect. Our granddaughter, aged 3, was staying with us in Buffalo while her parents were on vacation. I reveled in the delight of having her to myself. It had been a perfect day. We had picked flowers, visited the zoo, baked cookies together. I gave the child a pink bubble bath, relishing her squeals of delight. I dressed her in a ruffled nightgown and put her between sweet-smelling sheets in her mother's former bed, her stuffed animals all around her. A perfect end to a fun-filled day in Grandma's house, right down to the bright white muslin curtains. As was routine, Grandpa read her a book. She kissed him and said nighty-night to her room, her animals, and the moon in her storybook. A few moments later, I returned to tuck her in. She looked wistful and sad, her eyes filling with tears. "What's wrong?" I asked. "I miss my mommy," she said softly. "I want my mommy." "Mommy and Daddy will be back soon," I managed to reassure her, rocking her in my arms until her lids were drooping. But there, out of the shadows, out of the stillness, came the longings, the whispers, the agonizing cries of children I had heard. Anguish and sadness swept over me, drowning me in bitterness. I saw my grandchild's eyes flicker, her long lashes against her tanned cheeks. The corners of her lips went up ever so slightly in a smile, but I got no comfort from the image. Tossing and turning that night, I tried to keep the demons at bay, but found it futile. Finally, I got up, went downstairs, and sat at the window, watching the dawn gradually light the sky. Eventually, the brightness of the morning and the waking child's chatter made the ghosts retreat into the shadows. I was fortunate to have had a happy childhood, one that in all probability was not as perfect as I have chosen to remember. But its memory has helped me survive, and I have used it as a beacon to illuminate the darkness of the tragedy that followed, just as I often use the darkness of past despair to show me the blessings which I might otherwise take for granted. As I have grown and matured, I have learned better to understand my parents, to grasp the burden which this period of horror imposed on them. As a teenager living through it, I could not fathom the enormity of the collapse of their world, my world. That is my most bitter regret. I still look to their memory for guidance, even though in my own life I have been granted decades beyond what they had. They are my parents, and I will need their approval to the end of my days. By the same token, my children will always be children, and the urge to protect them will never diminish. I had been some years in Buffalo when, on a cold February morning, a miraculous incident brought me into possession of the complete collection of my family photos. They had been found purely by accident by a distant relative who happened to visit Belitz after the war and by chance encountered a former neighbor of ours who had promised at the time of our forced departure to store our most precious family belongings until our return. Of those valuables, she returned what she ironically considered of no worth, thereby inadvertently saving my irreplaceable and most meaningful treasure. The battered brown box yielded some 400 photos which had been insured for $10. They were the familiar snapshots and studio photos of my parents, grandparents, friends, neighbors, and classmates. Here was a cross-section of their lives salvaged from the abyss. Families in all their finery at weddings, young people in hiking gear, men posing elegantly in bowler hats or proudly showing off their World War I Austrian uniforms. The camera had caught them gravely staring into the lens or exuding an air of confidence in the future against the obviously fake backgrounds that were so common in photographers' studios in those days. The click of the shutter had frozen their images, and I was awestruck to think that I could mentally roll back that film and make them come alive. I could recall their names, remember moments we had shared. I knew much of their beginnings, and in many cases, the time and place of their tragic end. I can only wonder now, did those faces reflect an age of total illusion? The loss of my brother is the hardest to bear. The anguished uncertainty of how he died and where his bones rest comes back at the most unexpected times. Even now, at 70, I still look for my big brother to shield me, to fight my battles for me. Somehow, I am still seeking him in the naive belief that if only I could find him, he would be able to restore that lost world. A strange incident occurred which put some balm on that still festering wound. At our final parting, when I was 15 and my brother 19, he asked me to be brave and take care of our parents. My promise to him was my most sacred vow, and during the years that followed, I did the best I could, always, I suppose, in the hope that he would praise me when we next met. How could I have imagined that on a snowy winter's night many decades later, in a suite at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York, Prime Minister Menachem Begin of Israel would express the fulfillment of part of that irrational hope when he took me into his arms and said, "I've waited so long to meet Arthur's little sister." As I wept, he stroked my hair and said, "You have been very brave." He had never met my brother, but had read what I wrote about him, and with uncanny sensitivity, he had identified with us. Thus he gave me the praise I had hoped to hear from my brother. And then there are other comforting moments when I meet the few friends who survived the camps with me. We reminisce about the past without ever forgetting the fulfillment we have found in the present. I am most deeply grateful whenever my friends mention the skits I wrote under the cover of darkness, which for brief moments would make us forget the horror of the reality we were living in. I feel proud and humble at having been granted that privilege and consider it my greatest achievement, even though it may not have been an act of total selflessness. I have learned that when we bring comfort to others, we reassure ourselves, and when we dispel fear, we assuage our own fear as well. Inevitably, we all revert to the core of our existence in moments of crisis and look for our lodestar. I have tried to follow mine ever since I left my parents and my childhood home. I know full well what saw me through those unspeakable years. It was the powerful memory of an evening at home, the living room of my childhood. My father smoking his pipe and reading the evening paper, my mother working on her needlepoint, my brother and I doing our homework. The lamps throwing a soft glow around the room as my cat, stretched out on the green patterned carpet, purred softly. An evening at home. How many times I saw that picture, from my bunk in the camps, looking down on the barbed wire, during the bitterness of bone-chilling nights during the death march. Those evenings at home that I have thought dull and boring. The desire to know them once more became a driving force, leading to survival. I never saw my childhood home again, nor any member of my family. But their images at times merge into those of my husband and are recreated in my children. I am home again. After nearly half a century, the opportunity presented itself for my return to the scene of the last chapter of that dark past. My husband, children, and my friends made a pilgrimage to Volary, Czechoslovakia, the place where I was liberated, the site where the curtain closed on the tragedy, where the stirring of love and hope blossomed again in the springtime of my life. We went back in the autumn, and for Kurt and me, in the autumn of our lives. Although everything had changed for me, nothing there seemed to have changed. As if frozen in time and memory, I stood again in the doorway of the abandoned factory, where I first greeted the freedom I had dreamed about for so many years. I paused at the graves of my beloved friends, who were never privileged to know the joy of freedom, the security of a loaf of bread, or the supreme happiness of holding a child in their arms. I listened to the gentle wind in the trees, to the screech of a bird, and I looked at the flickering memorial candles on the headstones of their graves. It brought up the unanswerable question that has haunted me ever since the day I left them there. Why? I lingered at the window of what used to be the American Field Hospital, now a furniture factory, where I then lay in critical condition for many months. It was the window next to my double-decker bunk, in which I awoke on my first day of freedom to ask myself, why am I here? I am no better. Standing there, I prayed, in the hope that perhaps through my life's work, I might have provided a fragment of the answer and given back a small part of what I have received. My debt of gratitude is boundless to my husband, Kurt, and to our children, Vivian and Jim Ullman, Leslie and Roger Simon, and Lynn and Jim Klein. I owe thanks to my friends, my community, and the countless people who over the years have given me their friendship and encouragement. In that connection, I feel compelled to mention the person who, perceptive of all that passed in my early years, generously opened the door to my career. To my publisher, Arthur W. Wang, my profoundest gratitude, however inadequately expressed, for his trust, his vision, and his friendship, which made so much of everything possible. Goethe Weissman Klein, Arizona, August, 1994.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.